Luke, it's so great to be together and to draw out some of the themes in economics and ethics that I think are so important for our Francesco investor community to begin to wrestle with. So just as a starting point, help orient us to your own formation and some of your journey that brought you to where you are today.
Great to be with you, Felipe. Such an important conversation. So if I gave a little bit of background to me, I kind of come to the work slightly strangely. I left university 1991-ish and actually went, after working for a little bit in Parliament, went to work for an investment bank, or what we used to call back in the day a merchant bank, called Warburgs. It no longer exists, I fear. And this was at the time of just after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And I was tasked as part of the Warburgs at that time had been received a huge amount of money from the World Bank to oversee the mass privatization of Polish industry. And so I was working on the privatization of Polish airlines. And very much the orthodoxy at that time was obviously Western capitalism had won. We just needed to marketize everything and reinstall private property regimes without regard to questions of kind of social society and social flourishing, without regard to environmental questions, and without regard to questions of political stability. The market would solve everything. I was very quickly very disillusioned by this and thought this was a slightly bonkers kind of way of looking at things, but was very committed to that transition process and went to work, had the opportunity to go and work for a Christian charity working in Central Eastern Europe and a bit in Russia and Central Asia as well throughout that time, and did that for about 6 or 7 years. And this was a context where the kind of European Marxist project had died. In its place, you had a turbocharged, often kind of kleptocratic capitalism, the legacy of state-run, skeletic socialist structures, and then every religion under the sun piling in to kind of proclaim the world, proclaim their particular word to the godless post-communist society. So you had this emergence of a kind of post-secular environment, hyper-plural. Christianity was being mobilized in that context for a kind of ethno-religious nationalist project. Think about the collapse of former Yugoslavia and the rise of ethno-religious nationalism there, both in Catholic forms in Croatia and in Orthodox forms in Serbia. But that was going on throughout the world. It just took particularly violent form in that former Yugoslavian context. And so seeing that in Russia, and that was often driven by populist leaders, people like Mechia, the rise of Putin, who were not really ideologically driven, very committed to kind of questions of power, but using all the old techniques, both of kind of capitalism and of the old Soviet system to kind of gain and secure power, a lot of them coming out of KGB and equivalent secret services kind of institutions. So it was a kind of fascinating context, very formative, and working the privilege of working ecumenically Catholic, Protestant, Orthodox figures who'd be involved in the underground church and in the pro-democracy movement, who had this very holistic, as we might say in Catholic terms, kind of integral vision of mission. And that profoundly shaped my sense, but also the sense that here was the world in which if you just had everything driven by markets, you commodified nature, you commodified people, you destabilized democracies or existing political structures, and you didn't really foster the kinds of ecologies of trust and then the institutional forms which allow for social stability and greater kind of equity to be displaced. And what you actually generated instead was highly inequitous and corrupt and environmentally destructive forms of life. And how is the church going to be a witness within that? So that kind of led into various questions and fell into really doing a PhD, trying to answer those questions of how does the church navigate this kind of context as a faithful witness? And that's really the kind of backdrop to a lot of my reflections. And I'll say a little bit more about how we think about this kind of context, because I think it was really a foreshadowing of our own context, which we're struggling with. And it's a context which very much emerges in the Atlantic world from the 15th century onwards, if we kind of really push the date back. And often people look to 1492 and Christopher Columbus. I would say 1444 is really the kind of seismic change date. That's the date of...
Let me just interrupt you to recap a little bit before we jump into this Atlantic context piece, which is so important, because I think you just described some of your merchant banking ministry, formation Eastern Europe. You also spent time in kind of London and UK politics. Now you're based partly in the United States in Durham, professor of theology at Duke. But you're reflecting now on some of the mega trends that kind of shape our current moment. So continue on with this Atlantic kind of analysis.
I should say the beginning of the journey of then involved in various forms of both church-based and democratic kind of life, both in the UK, Europe, and then now here in the States as well, where I teach at Duke. But yeah, so just to pick up where I left off, the if we trace 1444, it's the first slave market in Portugal. And you see from that point on, it's not just the commodification of people, the treating of people as a commodity to be bought and sold. But in that is also the destruction and commodification of whole ecologies as well. And we see the kind of creation, destruction, and reforming, for better and worse, of cultures and societies around the Atlantic basin from that as they interact, and particularly around the plantation economy, which is both a slave-driven economy and a monoculture, deeply destructive of both indigenous populations in the Caribbean and elsewhere, and their and the ecologies of those islands and Brazil and elsewhere. And so the interaction really around the Atlantic basin is going on. Meanwhile, Europe, obviously, influx of gold, silver, is both destabilizing their economies and enabling them to kind of advance in certain ways. What we see through this process, through this history, is on the one hand, a deeply extractive vision of economic life. We treat people and the places they're from simply as a resource to extract value. So nature itself becomes merely a platform on which we perform our lives and a resource to extract and power our lives from. That we don't need to learn anything from nature. It's not we're leaving behind the world of Thomas Aquinas and natural law, where observation of nature can teach us something about how to live well, and all people, that's available to all people. Somehow we know best how others should live, and we impose meaning on them and on the places they're from, and that highly voluntaristic kind of idea. And that becomes the regnant framework. And that's obviously deeply embedded in how we think about economics as well. And so then that all the time generates counter movements. Now, some of those are deeply reactionary counter movements. We can think of something like fascism. And many of those, though, are also democratic. We think about slave revolts, the emergence of movements like the abolitionist movement, the trade union movement, various democratic social movements around the world. Because if you treat nature and people as commodities, you destabilize and liquefy everything, and life becomes impossible. And so there's always going to be a reaction against that, but that reaction can either be anti-democratic or democratic in form in the modern world. And we see both of those variants. And the state can be aligned with either one or other. It can either be aligned with forms of deeply totalitarian counter movement to try and stabilize life on the land, or it can be aligned with forms of democratic movement. But the paradox is, of course, that the state both creates this world. You can't have open markets. Most markets operate at a kind of local level, and then you have tariffs and taxes and things to kind of negotiate as a buffer between the country and the city, and then between regions, and then between countries. It's state-driven projects which create more and more open markets, first regionally, then nationally, and then globally, with things like NAFTA and World Bank and the emergence of the kind of Bretton Woods and then subsequent developments, Washington Consensus, etc. But these are state-driven projects to create open markets in which people and places and money can flow. And then the state has to be called on to recalibrate that, because no one can live within no one can live on the sea, basically. You can't live, you have to live on the land, which is stable, which entails cultivation, which entails social relationships. You can't live on the water, the unregulated, highly mobile world of global capitalism or the ancient maritime economy or the medieval maritime economy or the early modern maritime economy. There's always a, this is a perennial dynamic, the conflict between land and sea. And so philosophically, when we think about this, we've got the emergence in the modern world, and we can think of here of someone like Thomas Hobbes, classically, of the kind of social contract tradition, and how this is also an economic tradition all the time of thinking about economic life together. We can think about the life. Humans are individuals, individual choosers, who are fundamentally in competition with each other. And the fundamental condition of human life is one of scarcity. And nature is a realm of necessity to be overcome through science and technology, but is fundamentally the enemy to be defeated so that we might be free. And that is the kind of, still, I would say, the dominant frame of reference. And then you need forms of calculating reason, Weber's iron cage, bureaucratic, juridical, economic knowledges to command and control and have mastery over nature and mastery over people to ensure efficient and effective outcomes. Now, that's a very different vision to what I think, which drives Catholic social teaching and a whole range of other, we can think of Christian socialism, Christian democratic thought, a kind of Christian civic humanist traditions as well. Sorry, I can't hear.
Thank you, Luke. That's so helpful. Yeah. Let's turn to that in a second here, this civic humanism and the vision going forward. But just to recap, you kind of just rendered a kind of a couple important critiques, kind of a political economy, talking about Hobbes in particular here and the fundamental scarcity. And that still influences and infects almost all of our mainstream economic thinking and especially our investment thinking and how we treat nature and kind of going back to this commodification of people and nature. And so you're now just about to turn to how we might insert ethics and Catholic social teaching first as a big piece here.
Well, I'm just I thought I'd just lay out a little bit more of how that vision shapes both the kind of philosophical commitments and then the economic visions as well.
Okay.
And how we think about that. So I think basically you've got this counter vision draws on a very ancient tradition of thinking. We can think of, you know, going back to Aristotle. Are we fundamentally social and political animals who cannot survive, let alone thrive without others? Or are we atomized individual monads who contract with each other and then bounce off each other in a kind of consumer set of exchanges? And obviously, I think in a Christian view, we are social, fundamentally socially political. It's a relational anthropology. I can't become a person without others. And then there are certain conditions which enable me to become a person in and through the quality and character of my relationship with others. And so here, fellowship is fundamental. Competition is a fall. Property is you can have a counter property, but it's a social good which serves social flourishing, not an absolute good which the individual has absolute mastery over. And that's very much kind of Catholic social teaching view, and there are others aligned with that. And here then we can play out theologically very different responses to this world that emerges in the Atlantic system. We can either have a theology which says capitalism is a providential way of meeting the problem of scarcity and of addressing and provisioning human needs. Or we can have a kind of view of it as a almost a second fall, or it's the modern form of Babylon. It's the earthly city, which actually we're always having to counter and bear witness within what does a vision of human flourishing within this, but not accepting its terms and conditions. And I would say that is the Catholic social view. Now, it's different from a kind of radically apocalyptic view, which says you need to burn down Babylon. It's still there's a modulating, there's a reforming. You don't have to accept capitalism. It is the earthly city, but you're not called to leave it, as in Jeremiah 29:7. You're called to bear faithful witness within it and transform and convert it. But that does mean you can't accept its terms and conditions as good. So there, we have these very different theological kinds of responses. And then economically, I think, there's two very different understandings of how you proceed, which flow out of that. On the one hand, on the kind of philosophical and theological view of us as individual choosers, you have an idea that economic rationality, we're calculating self-interested, competitive individuals who are making economically driven, rational decisions about how to operate in the marketplace. And that's the normative vision of the human, which drives modern economics in most of its forms.
And where does that come from again?
I would say that flows directly out of the kind of philosophical and theological, it's kind of voluntaristic and nominalistic, to give it its kind of key terms. And you can trace that back to people like William of Ockham and into the medieval era, but it takes particularly sharp form coming out of social contract theories, Locke, Hobbes, others in the modern period, and how that feeds into kind of development of different economic views. But yeah, so I think on that view, then what is the economic logics you operate by? It's highly technocratic, calculating, data driven, kind of cost benefit analysis, which is all about efficient means to effective causes. Efficiency and effectiveness is the key kind of criteria, driven by the only business of business is business, i.e. the bottom line profit margin is what really, really matters. That's the only thing that really matters. But inherently in saying that, you're making society and politics serve money, not money and markets serve social and political flourishing. And so it subordinates the human, who is a social and political animal, to economic calculation, which is to put mammon before God and put mammon before persons. Now, the contrary view is a view of economic calculation as a prudential matter. Economics is an art, not a science. It's about the cultivation of the household and shared communities of life. And here, this view of the human is we're desiring social animals who need others to survive, let alone thrive. How do we provision forms of social flourishing based on prudential judgment making, which are contestable and contingent? There's no claim that somehow we're finding some, hidden law. We have close observation. There can be data. There can be analysis. There can be close kind of attention to the world as it is to understand how we are relating, what's going on here. In preface to a judgment about what then do we do, but it's a very different orientation. It's practical reasoning, not technical reasoning, which is driving the judgments. And I think fundamentally when we come to think about investment decisions, it's what vision of the human is driving the underlying kind of economic judgment making, what understanding of rationality is driving that? Is it a kind of prudential rationality or a kind of economic utilitarian calculus? And then what vision of and what understanding of is economics and economic criteria the only criteria and the predominant criteria? Or is it economic and the provisioning of a life embedded in and serving some prior and more basic view of human flourishing, however we want to determine that? And obviously in Catholic social teaching, in terms of integral ecology, and there's a quite determinant vision of that. But the more basic question is, do our economic judgments and calculations serve that good, that moral good, or is our kind of our understanding of social political life subordinated to economic calculations?
Luke, these are bold, bold questions here to ask. And I think fundamentally, I find myself in my own economic decision-making lodged in the conventional logics. And it's so hard to break free because all of the investment advisors, all of the people that are supposedly supporting you for actualizing your faith visions. And so often what we notice is it gets reduced to Catholic compliant investing by a set of criteria that we're not investing in arms manufacturers. And so it isn't even asking the harder question of what vision of the human do we have, what understanding of rationality, and how is our economic criteria lining up against this other provisioning of a life? So if we were to begin to center some of those other things, I've begun to put forward that to have Catholic embodied investing, to have faith embodied investing, we have to start with a well-formed conscience, right? And that requires an encounter out in the world. And then there also needs to be this component of discernment and engagement with theology and doctrine. Is that a way to think about it? Or how might we imagine faith embodied investing? You said asking the questions you offered, but in a more
practical. Yeah. I think there's a couple of things to say in this. In a sense, you know, obviously well-formed conscience is part of it, but how do we develop a well-formed conscience? And that really relates to who are we listening to. So if I'm just listening to the denizens of the financial service industry who are insulated and frankly kind of have, we might say, slightly autistic visions of the human, which aren't fully relational, which aren't deeply personal, that's probably, if I'm only getting my counsel from them, that's not going to be a good source of wisdom. I'm not going to make wise decisions which enable the flourishing of creation and neighbor and myself. So then I think the question is, are we listening? Whose voice counts in determining what is the good we're pursuing? Again, those in the financial services industry are just going to be operating with a strictly econometric frame of reference. So then there's a question of the preferential option for the poor. How do we hear the cry of those who are rendered disposable or commodified or whose ecologies on which they depend are being destroyed by the investment decisions we're making? Does their voice count? And how do we include those voices in the deliberative process of seeking good counsel, the virtue of what Thomas Aquinas called eubolia, that kind of ability to hear empathetically advice from others, even when it contradicts your own commitments. That's a virtue, the virtue of being able to seek wise judgment. And I think we need to encourage that in that kind of virtue formation through hearing other kinds of voices at the point of decision making. And again, when we do it through Catholic compliant procedures or just reference kind of changing public policy, what we're doing is we're outsourcing and proceduralizing the process of decision making. And we're not recognizing that as social and political animals who are fundamentally come to discover who we are and how to relate to reality around us so that our thriving can be sought, whether in economically, politically, or socially, through relationship with others, we're essentially rendering into an abstract process what should be a relational communal discernment, which is contingent and contested. And what we've decided today might change tomorrow. There is always an element of contingency, and that makes us very nervous. But and economics in one level is an attempt to overcome the problem of contingency by providing laws that tell you just do this and you'll be fine. But there's a kind of that also, I think, relates to a profoundly theological point, which is, I think, to make faithful decision, there is in some sense a renunciation of control. There's a rendering oneself vulnerable to others not like you. And a renunciation of a claim to somehow have mastery over, and a recognition of an interdependency with. And so that's a very different place out of which to make these judgments. Feels much riskier and insecure. But I think we can point to lots of forms of business and ways of doing business. Mondragon, others, cooperative forms, which take this deeply relational view, contestable communal discernment, and the prioritization of social and political life over economic kind of factors, as how you derive good economics. And so I think that that is very contrary to the kind of mainstream views. But I do think that that gets at this kind of fundamentally different anthropology, understanding of how we come to know the world and the theological frames of reference that what it means for us to do economics as Christians.
So grateful for that analysis, Luke, and it helps make it much more rich and practical. You also come from a community organizing background where you often ask the question about power, and many of our asset stewards recognize there's a limited amount they can do as a religious congregation or as a diocesan leader or as a, you know, Catholic Healthcare Association or a much larger asset steward of a pension fund. These groups, I think part of we're called to be church as an economic actor and all of us lay people as part of this broader interdependent body. If we were to kind of analyze the powers that be in the world and try to invite ourselves into deeper discernment of what roles we can play as protagonists of transformation here, what kind of context or questions might you offer us to help ask that more with deeper integrity?
Yeah, so I think part of this more relational, prudential way of thinking about coming to economic judgments is this question of power. We recognize if I'm the illusion of mastery over nature and other persons, which always generates forms of bondage. So, which always then operate on the sense of freedom for me means bondage for others. You know, how is my leisure, my flourishing bought at the expense of someone else elsewhere, and increasingly who I can't see and therefore out of sight, out of mind. But that is the problem with this vision of freedom as freedom from, which is very different from a vision of freedom for social and political flourishing with others. And so freedom from is often then masks and built on burdening others so I might not be burdened. And I think here, attention to questions of power and who has agency is critical as part of the deliberative process. Not only who has power and agency in determining the economic decisions we make, but also how are the economic decisions and investment kind of decisions we're making shaping or reshaping existing power relations? So a very concrete example of that is, great example is from the Sunrise Movement in Australia, not the youth-led movement here in the US. But in Australia, they did this great analysis of trying to think through disinvestment in coal. So a compliant procedure would just say, don't invest in coal or fossil fuel industry. But that's kind of one, doesn't really get at the power question. What they did was thinking, where's the intervention and investment or disinvestment you can make that would really have a transformative impact? And that took a very close analysis of the financing and investment in coal and fossil fuels and what was driving that and who was driving that. Turns out the insurance industry, you can't build a coal-powered fire station or a mine without insurance. Insurance is pretty crucial bit of the financial services industry and itself has to manage risk. That took a lot of data analysis, really going deep into the records. You know, that's when you want your technocratic analysis, hard data, all the rest of it. But it was driven by a power analysis of where could you apply agency in the value chain that would have a transformative impact. So it then generated a campaign to work with insurers to say, look, climate change is going to generate massive risk for you and for those who invest in you and for those who take out insurance with you. It's actually not worth your while. You shouldn't, as a responsible investor, be investing in coal and further fossil fuel production. So you need to disinvest from that and invest in alternative forms of energy production. But it's a great example. And then the question of kind of that you know, it gets complicated because there are two sides to insurance. So they actually ended up doing both sides of insurance, but being very effective. And I think of the largest insurance companies in France, Britain, Germany, and in the States, I think 27 out of 32 have completely now disinvested from and won't insure mining, new mining operations and others. I can't remember that's exact figure, but it's something along those lines. But I think that's a great example of there you see that proactive engagement with power analysis, the data, understanding political economy through that power grid, not simply as a profit margin driven thing. Situating that in a longer term holistic vision of human flourishing in which climate change will profoundly affect that, and then being able to speak both economic languages and social political languages, as it were, to kind of communicate that to people in that industry. And obviously investment there is a key bit of that, but it's one bit of a broader rendering an account of what is going on here in a much more holistic way, where things like environmental change aren't just treated as externalities. And it's way beyond simply a kind of compliance type procedural approach.
That's so helpful, Luke. Thanks for that tangible example and how we can go deeper in our thoughtfulness about analyzing the broader systems we are part of. There's so many questions I could ask you here about universal ownership at pension funds today. I would love to kind of continue this conversation, but to close out today, this segment, just leave us with kind of at a high level, some of the work you're in the middle of now or doing, or just how you would encourage us to kind of, what questions you would ask people that day to day are in these decisions and don't have time to look above the fold too much. But if they would read some books, engage with some of these ideas you offered today, what kind of encouragements might you offer?
Yeah, I think the broader, I mean, I've done quite a lot of work around the questions of debt and how we think about debt. We tend to think about debt quite neutrally as simply a kind of economic thing. And obviously it's a very rich tradition of Christian thought, particularly strong in Catholic thought, that really then feeds into thinking about Christian humanism and kind of emergence of Christian democracy in Europe and elsewhere, in Latin America and elsewhere. But this question of how debt is a political tool and indebtedness, which I think is you know, think about student debt, medical debt, you know, the modern economy thrives on debt and who has access to cheap credit and who doesn't, who pays more for money and who doesn't. And that's really at the heart of our financial services industry at the moment. So I think thinking about debt politically is pretty key to a kind of faithful discernment of investment practices and an engagement with just practices of lending and credit and then the kind of so I think that's one key area which we really need an imagination for and debt isn't neutral in that sense. So it's both, it's, there's a great word Plato has for a medicine. It means both it's a poison and it's medicine. And it's this idea, debt has that similar ambiguity. It's both medicine and poison. And what happens at the moment is we make it poison for the poor and medicine for the rich. And we just need to ensure that that is not the way it goes. And that's how it does go, unfortunately, in our contemporary context. So I think that's one key area. And then I think the other is thinking about this question of what is a Christian vision for a democratic political economy is key. And why I say that is because it goes back to this idea of, if we are social and political animals created in the image of God who need others to survive, let alone thrive, and that we have to have some agency in relationship with others to shape our conditions of our living and working conditions, then it's key to think not just politically, but also in the economic realm. And the Catholic tradition has been great at this in terms of support of trade unions. How do I exercise my agency in collaboration with others so that I, as a person in community with others, might thrive, whether that's in the firm, whether that's in my neighborhood, whether that's in my church, and notions of synodality. So this sense of, if we can broadly call that a kind of democratic political economy in which agency is distributed as widely as possible, and people's ability to act with and for others rather than simply be acted upon by either state or corporate capitalist structures is key to a Christian humanist vision of human flourishing, which was key to people like Jacques Maritain and the whole resistance to totalitarianism in the early 20th century, and this renewed commitment to democracy in recognizing that human flourishing was really what, and a Christian understanding of what it meant to be made in the image of God, was what was really at stake in either Fordist forms of capitalism, which rendered, you know, huge scale industrialization, which rendered the individual just as a cog in the wheel of industry, or state-driven forms of totalitarianism in the forms of fascism and communism. And both of those were deeply destructive of the human made in the image of God. And I think we're in a similar, it's more subtle, it's not so brutalizingly obvious, but the impact of AI, the impacts of surveillance capitalism, the impacts of deeply extractive views of the economy, both of human agents, you know, that we're kind of surveilled in the workplace and have our conditions of work, the kind of choice architectures, whether it's in medical systems, economic systems, wherever it is, are increasingly limited and our ability to act with and for others constrained. I think this is a major challenge. And so the recovery of authentically Christian humanism tied to a vision of a Christian vision of a democratic political economy is one of the real challenges of our day.
We'll leave it there. Thank you so much, Luke, for all these helpful insights. And I think I'm so grateful to, as you said, it's so important to have agency in collaboration with others, and how I think we as investors, we as Catholics, we as faithful people, we as people of goodwill, exercising our agency, need to do that in collaboration with others. So in that spirit, I'm so grateful in the Economy of Francesco to include you as one of our collaborators, Luke, and I'm sure we'll have more conversations. Thank you so much.
Great to be with you. Bye.